Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
All right. It is a Sunday morning wake-up call, Christmas week. We are pre-recording this. So as we record this, it is still before Christmas. So Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to you.
To you as well.
This is Sean McCord. I am stepping in for Rick Moore on the Sunday morning wake-up call with my guest, Katie Gary. Katie, thank you. You're looking ravishing this morning.
Oh, thank you. It's very generous of you.
And thank you for coming in. I know that this morning became unexpectedly busy for you.
Oh. Well, such is the life of a parent.
Exactly. So, Katie, you and I have known each other. We figured out recently that we've known each other casually for a few years, and I've worked with your husband before, and you and I recently did a project together. But what inspired me to bring you into the studio was a story that I saw from a few weeks ago in UVA Today about work that you're doing with business students at UVA. So what I'd like to do is talk about that, sort of jump into that, and then peel back a little bit and talk about your art and your arts background and how you're integrating that with your career, and then just kind of swing back around. So we'll start with the UVA Today story, which ran a few weeks ago. The headline was UVA Prof uses improv to educate students in ethical business situations. This is a story that ran on UVA Today on December 1st. And it talks about how you went into a commerce class and worked with students using improv techniques to help them become, it says right here, principled leaders in a corporate world that is too often tainted by unprincipled decisions. So I've heard of things like this. I was just talking to Jeff, our station manager, who has experience working with law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And he says that sometimes in law enforcement, they do similar things where they use role-playing to help police officers deal with situations. So talk a little bit about this, and then we'll broaden the conversation.
Okay. So it's not unusual. You see improvisational techniques used in many different areas of life, especially in business. It's become very popular. Mm-hmm. Popular way to help people broaden their creative thinking skills and comfort being in the moment. But I was kind of surprised that it hadn't been used yet in terms of difficult ethical situations.
Well, let's talk about, first of all, what are improv techniques? What's the core of improv?
Well, I'll describe a couple, but the thing that really comes up for me is when you hear these techniques, you think, oh yeah, that makes sense. There are things that are just there right in front of you, but you can't see it because you've never stopped to really think about it. One of the biggest improv techniques that's used, you know, especially for improv comedy, is the idea of yes and.
Yes and.
Yes and. That's right. Is, you know, it's the idea of if information is given by someone else in a situation, that your response should be affirmative.
To build on what someone is handing to you.
Yes, affirmative and inclusive and adding needed valuable information.
Mm-hmm. So we watch, people might go to an improv show or they might see one of these shows on TV where people shout out a situation, and then, you know, so, and suddenly, you know, there's an actor coming on stage and he's pretending, she's pretending to hold something and you don't know what it is. And then he says it's a bird. So the person opposite him says, no, that's not a bird. It's a monkey. He says, of course it's a bird. And they build from that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's taking what's happening in the moment and going forward with it rather than feeling the need to sculpt it with your own ego-driven needs.
Right. Right. So then how do you take those techniques and bring them into a business class where you're trying to teach situational ethics?
Well, my good friend, Carrie Carfagno, who is the professor of this class in ethical communication over in the McIntyre School of Commerce, mm-hmm. she and I sat down and just on a friend level started talking about what other solid techniques can we give to these students so that they can feel more comfortable and more in control in these ethical situations that pop up without any time to prepare for how you're going to react. You know, no matter how old you are, there are going to be times when you deal with difficult situations. Mm-hmm. It's a little easier the older you get. So we started crafting this class, and what I really discovered as we were working on it closely together is not only the yes and being able to take information given and work with it rather than shutting down and being fearful because you have an idea of what you think is happening. Sometimes when someone says something to you that you might, in your first reaction, you might be offended by or confused by or scared by, really, you may not clearly understand what they're saying. So our goal was to help them react calmly in the moment without judging what was being said first, and then be able to make a calm decision on how to proceed.
So I read in the UVA Today article that when you gathered with the students, one of the first things you said was, so how many of you followed up with the assignment that I emailed you?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of let that sink in for a moment because what, Katie?
I was terribly cruel to them. Because UVA students are notorious for being prepared and ready to go. Mm-hmm. And if they think they are not ready to go, they don't have a needed assignment, which is how I posed it.
And you didn't actually email them anything.
No, right. I had not given an assignment. There was nothing they needed to prepare. But
so there was a room full of people whose eyes were suddenly dilating.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it got quiet, and they were sneaking peeks at each other, like, what is she talking about? But what I wanted them to feel is the physical sensation that comes when you're surprised by something.
When you're unprepared for something.
When you're unprepared.
And then... So that feeling in the back of your skull or at the tips of your fingers.
Or in your gut.
In your gut, right. And then use that feeling.
Right, exactly. And because you can't deny it. Mm-hmm. And by not stopping, you know, I said the first thing you should do when you're hit and you don't know what to do is take a second and breathe and get control of your body, because if you can be in control of your body and that adrenaline is not pumping through your system, you're going to make much better choices and decisions going forward.
So I remember being that age, and you know, as we're both parents, we've read, I'm sure, a lot of articles about brain development and how frontal lobe brain development doesn't kick in, especially into young men, until later on in life. Mm-hmm. And I remember being that age. I remember when confronted with something that I wasn't prepared for, my first response would be to panic or to be defensive. And I remember getting to be about 24 and then just looking back at how I had behaved just, you know, like a year before and realizing, oh, I really didn't handle that well. Mm-hmm. So part of the challenge, I should imagine, is that you are working with students. You are working with young people. You are working with college students, most of whom, you know, their life experience is, you know, going from high school, going to college, you know, going to undergraduate school. Are you working with undergraduates and graduates?
Just undergraduates.
Just undergraduates, right. So these are young people who have been in school all their lives and haven't had many of those kinds of challenges. Mm-hmm. So how does that inform how they respond to these lessons?
Well, I think it's, they're very smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're very smart.
Sure, they're UVA students.
Absolutely. And so they know a lot, and they have a lot of information at their fingertips. And that is a blessing and a curse, I think. The curse part of it is, if you're talking about in a calm, open situation, how would you handle this difficult situation? It's easy to decide how you would handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us have a beautiful, high moral horse that we sit upon and trot through life. I know exactly what I'd do. But when you're actually in that situation, it's a little bit harder because
yes.
other variables are thrown in. Is this person your boss that mm-hmm. you're talking to?
Mm-hmm.
Are they asking you to do something inappropriate or something you think is unethical? Well, my friend Carrie calls it paycheck ethics. You know, when it comes down to how do I react when I'm thinking about I really need this paycheck,
right.
that may change how you respond.
Absolutely.
So you can be really smart and you can be confident in your beautiful ethics, but in the moment, you can still be thrown for a loop. And also, I reminded them that you are smart, and just because you're young doesn't mean that you need to be shy about being open and honest about your opinions.
Right. And about your failures.
Absolutely. And about not knowing what to do in mm-hmm. a situation. And being thoughtful about where you go to get assistance and support. So it's a being smart and prepared is a blessing and a curse. You just have to be mindful of it and not be and speaking cross generationally to mm-hmm. people as well. We all grew up in different environments, and someone who I'm in my late 40s talking to someone who's in their 60s or 70s, they're going to have a totally different experience of the workplace.
And technology and how workplaces have changed and relationships between men and women in the workplace.
Yes.
This is Sean McCord. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I am talking to Katie Gary, who is on faculty at UVA. What's your full title, Katie?
I am a lecturer.
A lecturer.
Yes.
Okay, so Katie Gary is lecturing me on improv techniques and business ethics. Katie, I'm remembering my first job out of college. I worked in a film office, and this was out in Los Angeles, and I was responsible for going out and picking up films from various studios and bringing them back to UCLA where I worked, and we would screen them there. And I picked up a film, and it was, it was a very trusted position because I had to drive onto studio lots. I had a permit. I would pick up a film, that was owned by the studio. I would drive it back to UCLA for a screening for a class, and then, I'd return it back to the studio, and I was driving all over the place. It was a great job for a kid who was 21, 22 years old and trying to get to know his way around L.A. I lost a film, Young Mr. Lincoln, from Fox. A Fox film. I remember this. And these are film canisters. These are film reels. These are big, heavy canisters that, that weigh 20, 30 pounds.
How did you lose it, John?
Well, so I was never quite sure. I remember I had all this paperwork, and one afternoon I was like, going to Universal to pick up one thing, going to Warner's to drop off something else, and my last stop was at Fox to drop off Young Mr. Lincoln, which I picked up a few days before. And I drove into the lot, looked in the back of the van, and it wasn't there. And so I made an excuse and drove back to my office, and it wasn't there. And so what I did was I didn't say anything to anybody. And I hoped, I don't even know what I was thinking. I hoped that nobody would find out. But this thing haunted me for over a week. And then one day the woman at the front desk said, "Oh, well, somebody came by looking for you. Apparently, he's got a film." I said, "What?" And it was like this guy who does maintenance and kept the machines running in the building. He said, "Yeah, I saw these cans of film sitting out in the hallway, and I didn't know what to do with them, so I picked them up and put them in my office." He'd been holding onto it for a week.
Oh my goodness.
So I had just like left it in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
They probably drove off without it, and then by the time I came back, the films weren't there anymore. But man, I was so nervous. I mean, I was so shaking. And what made things worse is that the person I had to report to was, how should we put it, not an understanding person.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me the film. I got it back to Fox. They didn't even notice that it was a week late. But I remembered this. And years later, when I was supervising here at UVA, and I was supervising students who were about that same age, and, you know, they would make a mistake. And I would, you know, I would remember, okay, that guy or that young lady is in the same position I was, you know, all those years ago. They didn't know what to do, and they panicked, and they just sort of went into instant denial. So, useful lesson for me, but I didn't have somebody come into a classroom and tell me how I should deal in a situation where I'm challenged. So what is the goal of these classes? What kind of situations are you trying to help these students with?
Interestingly, Carrie works a lot with ethical communication with her students. So she already had a collection of situations that her students have had to deal with before. Many of them, you know, it's so popular now to do internships.
Mm-hmm.
All through your educational career. So many of them had been in the workplace already. And so they would anonymously send them things that had happened to themselves or their peers or family members. And so she sent them to me, and we actually did a fair amount, and have heard since that they wanted to do more, which you always want to try it on for size a little bit more. We had them get up, and you know, one of the situations that they came up with, okay, you're in an office and a coworker has been involved in a bad car accident.
Mm.
And after the car accident, comes back and has suddenly become uber religious. Lots of paraphernalia in the cubicle and many conversations in the break room that were making others feel uncomfortable. And what do you do in that situation where you feel like their views are, you know, impeding on your space and your work, and that it's not quite appropriate?
Yeah.
So we had a couple students stand up and improv that. You know, what things could you say, and how could you make it that it was a positive conversation rather than, you know, putting someone on the defensive? That was one of the situations. Another one was a boss who asked to work up a marketing strategy for, I think it was a biscuit mix, that, you know, we want to do something that, you know, we have perhaps a Aunt Jemima type figure, and I want you to create the wording around that. And the person who was faced with that situation felt like it was entirely inappropriate and demeaning and just culturally insensitive. But what do you say to your boss when they feel certain they know exactly how to do things? So we talked about finding other strategies to get your point across without putting the other person down in the process. And we also did a lot of relaxation work in the class.
Right.
And that's really going back to, you can't deny your animal reaction. You can redirect it and use it to your benefit, but you have to deal with it first.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, you won't be able to make rational
right
decisions.
It's the fight or flight response.
Absolutely.
And it's there, and we have to recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have to say, okay, we're better than that. Mm-hmm. It is about 19 past the hour. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And we're back. It's the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is Sean McCord hosting this week while Rick Moore takes some well-deserved time off. Happy holidays to you, Rick. I'm sitting across from Katie Gary, a lecturer at UVA, but you've been at UVA for a while because you were a student here.
Yes. So I was here in the early 90s, 90 to 93, for graduate school in the University of Virginia Department of Drama.
Mm-hmm. So, what is your actual degree in?
It's an MFA in acting. Mm-hmm. Before that, I was at the University of Florida where I got a BFA in acting. Basically, that translates to 7 years of higher education and never leaving the building.
Right.
Always there. In undergrad, I had an 8 a.m. class every day of every year. I tell that to my students now when they complain about having a 9:30 class.
Are you a morning person, Katie?
I am now, more so than when I was younger. Back in those days, you just had to, you were cramming every minute you could.
Yeah, because these days, I don't know how good they got it.
Yeah, not complaining, but I don't feel too sorry for them when they say 9:30 so early.
So you came to UVA graduate school, and have you been here ever since?
No, after graduate school, my husband and I, and he's an actor as well.
And you met at UVA?
We met at UVA.
Mm-hmm.
And
your husband, Brian and I have known each other for a few years.
Mm-hmm. And we moved together to Chicago after graduate school and lived and worked there for several years. And then have moved all over the country, Denver, Florida, to my hometown. And then Brian found a job at UVA. It popped up one day. He was working at the University of Florida and decided, gosh, do we want to go back to Charlottesville? And why would you not want to come back to Charlottesville?
So right, so how long have you been back here?
We've been back here a little over 7 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. That's probably just about as long as I've known Brian.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, tell us what it was like here at UVA in the early 90s. Assuming some of your students might be listening, other than having to get up earlier.
Oh, yes. Well, the thing I usually tell them is imagine what it would be like if there were no computers.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I first got here, I had a fancy typewriter.
Right.
That had a little
LCD screen in it. Right. Yeah, I had one of those.
So you could type some things in, and then and make some corrections, which was a godsend.
Right. But maybe a whole paragraph.
A paragraph or two.
Yeah.
And then I think there was a way you could save it. Maybe there was like a hard disk or something.
Yeah, it was built in. You could see it. It was on a little tiny LCD screen, about 3 inches across. Mm-hmm. And it would scroll, the words would scroll along, sort of like a ticker on the bottom of CNN now. Mm-hmm. And so you could go back and sort of reread what you had read and say, oh, I misspelled that. There was no spell check.
Right.
You know, so you could maybe make some corrections and then print out mine, I think, almost up to a full page, as I recall. And it would come out with a little sort of linotype. Yeah, I've still got some of those papers in my files somewhere.
Absolutely. And so working with
that was advanced technology.
Oh, very advanced.
I mean, that was so cool.
I remember having friends borrow it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was very impressive. I was very excited to use it, especially, and I tell them, gosh, the rigmarole to produce our thesis papers, it was so nerve-wracking. That was more nerve-wracking than actually doing the work and doing the writing behind the thesis, is the formatting and printing out the copies and then taking it in, and they would get the ruler out, measure the margins and all this.
That was that was back when we regularly retyped things from scratch.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you type it out once, you go through, you correct it, you'd move things around, and then you type it again.
That's right. But then again, I remember my mom was, when she was working on her PhD, and I think I was 9 or 10, I would go with her. You hired someone to type for you.
That's right.
And so we would, she would have regular like check-in meetings with the very nice woman who typed for her, because it was just, when you had a huge document, it was labor intensive. So that's the first thing I tell my students is just imagine life with no computers, no Google search.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was a different world.
Yeah.
It was a different world. But where we lacked some things, we didn't know about it. We also had other advantages, just, you know, being in the theater department, or any theater department, I think, means spending hours and hours and hours with people who are interesting and passionate and hardworking and a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun that you form very deep friendships with people in short order.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because you are doing something successfully that interests me as well, and that is, you know, taking an arts background and applying it to your life and applying it to your career. Okay, I went to film school at UCLA many, many years ago. And you went to theater school at UVA Drama. And not everybody who goes to a school like that, a film school or a theater school, is going to go out and be a professional filmmaker or be a professional actor. You know, a lot of people are going to try. So, you know, you might graduate from UVA and go, you know, move to Chicago or New York or LA and try to make it in the business. And some people, you know, have successful careers, but we've never heard of them. But a lot of other people, you know, you have this background, and then you go out in the world, and it's something that really interests you, but you need to make a living. I graduated, and I realized that I wasn't willing to give up everything, you know, just for the sake of my art. I liked having a job, and I liked being able to pay rent and not have to share a house with, you know, three other guys and all that sort of stuff. I'm interested in hearing. I want to talk more about how you've taken your arts background and applied it to your life. But I want to talk a little bit more about your time at UVA, because I was doing some research here on you when I asked you to be my guest. And it turns out, and tell me if I get this wrong, that your parents were anthropologists in Africa, and you moved to a new girl at the high school, and there you met a math teacher who tried to get into mathletes. Did I get that wrong?
You're close.
I'm describing the plot of Mean Girls. Why am I describing the plot of Mean Girls?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, the main character in the very popular, I would dare say, cult classic among some groups.
Definitely a classic, yes.
Film Mean Girls is named Katie, and it's spelled
Katie Heron.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spelled the same unusual way that I spell my first name, which is C-A-D-Y.
And they make a point of that in the film several times.
They do. And it's particularly funny because Tina Fey, who wrote and acted in that movie, was a good friend and my roommate for part of my time.
You guys were college roomies.
Yeah. Tina was an undergrad, and I was a graduate student. But at UVA, there's not really a huge separation between undergraduate and graduate studies. I mean, different classes, but you're still working on shows together and stuff like that.
So you were like her older learned mentor.
Yeah, but I think I'm only like a year older than Tina, which, you know, sometimes I would say to her, well, I am older.
Right.
And she would say, yeah, a year. I don't think it makes any difference. So not that much. Matter of fact, our birthdays are only like 2 days apart. So, I mean, it's like literally a year older. Of course, back then, I used every day I could get, and now I'm like, it's only a year.
Exactly.
It's only a year.
Yeah.
So, and after she graduated, she also moved to Chicago. So we.
Well, I was going to ask if you were if you were still connected when you guys were up there.
We were. Matter of fact, she helped us. My now husband was boyfriend then. Find an apartment, helped us move in, which was particularly harrowing because we had rented this apartment on the fourth floor. And there was no elevator, and Tina helped us lug furniture all the way up to the fourth floor when we had, like, driven from Virginia with the U-Haul, you know.
See, well, that's where being a year younger than you came in handy. She had all those, had all those muscles. She could,
right.
So when you and your husband Brian moved to Chicago, what was your goal? What did you want to do there?
Well, we hoped to act quite a bit, which we did.
Were you taking improv?
I did. Matter of fact, Tina had already started taking improv classes.
Right.
I don't remember if there were any improv classes. I don't think any comedy improv classes. Of course, in theater training, there's a lot of improv work, but it's not specifically usually for the goal of creating a funny stage performance, or like you would see on Whose Line Is It Anyway? It's not generally that type of study.
And thank you. That's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about, because I took a little bit of improv myself, and the thing, that lesson that I took away from it was that I don't really belong in improv. But I mean, you know, we talk shows, we see shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway? And you know, we think of improvisational comedy, and that's what we think of when we say improv, but it's actually deeper than that. So talk about that.
So the type of work that's really used, I think, in actor training for improv is to take what you know about a character or situation and to put yourself in that place. You know, the Stanislavski magic if.
Right.
What would I do if I was in this situation? What would I do if I had lost my job and I was alone on the streets? You know, how would I react if someone said this line to me? So it's more as a training in terms of thinking and reacting verbally, but also physically in the moment, and connecting physical gesture and vocal performance to the needs of the given circumstances of the moment. It's very, you think when you read a play script, oh, I know what's happening, I can just say this line, but there's a lot more to saying a line than just saying the words. And until you get in that situation, it's, again, one of those things that you think, oh, that's easy. I mean, almost everyone I talk to says, oh, I thought I would be an actor for a while.
Right.
And it's true. It's something that's very attractive to people, but it's, you don't really realize the level of detail of work and practice and rehearsal and thought that goes into crafting something on stage or on film.
You don't. My guest, Katie Gary, is schooling me on what it means to be an actor. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm Sean McCord. So, let's talk about that. Now, I did some, back when I was in college, I did some theater, but nothing on stage. It was like crewing, and loved that. A few years ago, here in Charlottesville, I became involved in theater again when my son, who was 12 years old, was in a show at Live Arts, and I started hanging out there and realized, oh, I really like this. You know, I had sort of left that part of my life behind. And I had the great fortune of working at Live Arts, writing some shorts, doing a little directing, and then I actually got cast in a play, my first play a few years ago.
What was it?
It was Superior to Donuts at Live Arts.
Oh, okay.
I auditioned basically on a dare, because I was directing a short play and talking to my actor about how directing was going to better inform my writing. You know, writing is what I do first. And he said, well, you know, if you really want to know what an actor goes through, you should audition. And he was right. I'd never auditioned. I'd never been on that side of the table before. And he said, I've got this play coming up. There's a really great role. Don't audition for the role I'm auditioning for, but there's another great piece. You should audition for that. And so I did. And it was an amazing experience. Being on that side of the table. And fortunately, since I was just auditioning on a dare, I wasn't nervous at all. I was just having fun with it. And I was a little thrown off when they actually called me up and offered me the part. I mean, I said, you know who you're talking to, right? But I got into it. And the thing that I discovered right away, you know, when I talk to people now, and I've now done some more acting. When I were in a show a few weeks ago, I kind of dabble in it. And the thing is, what I've tried telling people, because what people get hung up on is, how do you memorize all those words? And I get it. It is a lot of work, and it is hard. And it is the hardest thing to do at the beginning. But it's kind of like running. My wife is a runner. Mm-hmm. And I've heard other people describe this before, where you get out there and you first start running and that first mile kills you. But you go a little further the next time, and then, you know, and then the second. But you get to a point where you kind of break through a wall, and it doesn't become easier, but it's like you're at a different plane now. Now you're really running. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what kind of being on stage is like. Mm-hmm. Memorizing the words, because at first they're just words. That's just work. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. Mm-hmm. But then you break through it, and it's no longer just words that you're saying. It's you're inhabiting a character. Mm-hmm. And you become true to that character, and you become that person. And if you've never been on stage and you hear someone talking about that, I mean, when I heard actors talk about that before, I just thought it sounded schizophrenic. But it's true. When you're doing a performance, you know, you're not just an actor reciting words that a writer has written. You are being a person, and you have a responsibility to them. And you've created that character in your mind, and you've filled in what we call backstory in the theater, that the writer may or may not have included. So you know that when you respond a certain way, it's not just the words that you're saying, but it's how you say them and the feelings that you have inside. You have to have all those feelings at the time. You have a responsibility to that character to be true to them. And it's got to be the same way in improv, as you said. Mm-hmm. You know, you're building on. Yes, you have a responsibility to whoever it is that you're portraying on stage at that moment. You know, even if it's a character that 5 seconds ago somebody said, you are a train conductor on a train that the brakes have been lost and it's hurling down the tracks at 200 miles an hour, and your job is to go in and calm the passengers. Bang.
Right.
That's the person you have to be at that moment.
Absolutely.
So those kind of techniques, you're bringing these lessons to students, mm-hmm. but what are moments that they've helped you in your life as a career person, as a parent, as a spouse?
Wow, that's a great question.
Thank you.
How have they helped me? Well, they help me every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, in the class that I teach a large intro to theater class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a lot of students who come from across grounds who really probably have no interest in theater. They're taking a class.
Sounds like an easy credit.
Right.
They may not be theater students. They may never have thought about theater before.
Absolutely. I have many people who've never seen a play before.
Really?
Yes. Which always surprises me, but then it really excites me, because I'm just excited that I'm able to help them discover something they've never seen and has the potential to be a part of their lives going forward. But what I have to constantly remind myself is to kind of go back to that idea of beginner's mind.
Mm-hmm.
That the things that I take for granted that I do all the time, breath work, relaxation work, being a good collaborator, that as part of my training and part of my makeup now, many of them have never been exposed to. So just this semester, I got to the point where I start every class with a breathing exercise. And just, you know, very simple. I do different things, you know, full body relaxation scans or humming work or just very simple things. And at first, I got a lot of grumbles and a lot of looks around the room like, is she crazy? But I can't tell you, at the midterm point, and as I've just finished reading finals from people, how many people have said, I thought that was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But now I do it all the time. And before I go in for an exam or if I have to give a presentation, I take a second and stop and do some breathing work. And I'm like, yes, that's great.
Well, you know what? We want to do another PSA.
Okay.
The last thing we can have on the radio is dead air. So let's. So, but for the people who are listening to the broadcast or listening to the podcast, mm-hmm. let's set up a breathing exercise for them, and then we'll switch to an announcement. So, okay. What would you tell your students? Okay. What is a breathing exercise?
A very simple one that I do for them is to have them. If they're sitting down, take everything off their lap, and usually that means their phone
mm-hmm.
or their computer. Put it on the ground, both feet flat on the floor, hands relaxed in your lap, close your eyes. Inhale for the count of three, and imagine that the breath is going all the way down to the tips of your fingers and the ends of your toes, filling your body. And then slowly exhale to the count of three. And then again, inhaling, this time to the count of five, and filling your body, and then exhaling to the count of five, and then go up to seven. See if you could do seven, that deeply inhale and exhale.
All right. So I hope you all at home are doing your breathing exercises.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with six area locations.
It is the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is Sean McCord, sitting in for Rick Moore. And my guest today is Katie Gary, lecturer at UVA, and once upon a time you infiltrated the plastics and brought them down. Yes, I'm doing another Mean Girls reference.
Oh yes, that's right. Oh my gosh, yes. You could also say, and on Wednesdays we wear pink.
Mm-hmm.
Hear a lot from my teenage daughters.
Mm-hmm. So I watch. I will confess, Katie, I rewatched the movie the other night because my kids have watched it over the years, and it's one of those very quotable films.
Mm-hmm.
And I laughed at she doesn't go here anymore, she doesn't even go here, which is a line that I had forgotten was from the film, and that my kids, you know, it was one of those lines, I guarantee, that my kids would say, and they'd all laugh. So we're pre-recording this, so we're not live now, so we can't take telephone calls. So I'm going to have to take the part of a caller, because if people were able to call in now and talk to you, I'm sure, as they always do, they'd want to know about Tina Fey. Are you still in touch?
We are, not very often. Everyone is busy with lives and work
and children and all
that stuff. But we occasionally connect, and I saw her, I think it was 2 years ago.
2 years ago when she came here to UVA.
Right.
Yeah.
She did the great inaugural, I believe.
Inaugural of the President's Arts Scholars.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Big talk that she gave on the in the amphitheater.
Yeah, that was great. That was fantastic. I was so fortunate that I got tickets to that, and I was sitting pretty darn close. I was like fifth row.
You were closer than I was. That was great.
Yeah, yeah.
But she did a great job with that, as Tina always does. I mean, she's an incredibly smart person.
Mm-hmm.
But she has a great way of being smart, but also funny and comfortable and casual.
Yeah.
And I think she left presents under people's chairs. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah. There wasn't...
Was it a CD of Sondheim?
It was a play that she had done when she was here. It was a female playwright.
Was it Carol Churchill?
Yes. Yes.
It wasn't Top Girls. It was another Carol Churchill. It'll come to
me
soon. Yeah,
not Mean Girls, but yeah, as soon as we wrap this up. Anyway, it was a great day. She was hilarious. She was sweet. She was so smart.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure people are going to ask, wow, when you were roommates with Tina Fey, did you know that she was going to become, Tina Fey?
I tell people all the time, no. You're working with a lot of talented people, and
right.
there's no way to predict where lightning will strike. Everyone I knew at that time was talented and smart and hardworking, and so it could have been anyone who gained that sort of success in that manner.
Right.
And many of them have gone on to do work in television and film and playwriting and directing and
right.
all that stuff.
Not everyday household names, but highly successful people
right,
in their fields,
right.
Yeah.
Where Tina's difference was is that, boy, she has a quick, dry wit.
Yeah.
And she is observant. She saw everything. And she had a little marble composition book that she carried with her everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And she was constantly making notes. And she was a playwright,
mm-hmm.
and wrote several really great plays while she was at UVA.
Not at all surprising.
Nope. And then when she went to Chicago, she started immediately taking improv classes at Improv Olympic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a branch of improv training that you've probably not heard of. I'm sure you've heard of Second City.
Everyone's heard of Second City, sure.
Improv Olympic is equally as great, if not better, in terms of a type of improv called long-form improv,
mm-hmm.
which is basically like, it's improv, but it has a structure, and you play with a team. And so everyone on the team knows first, we get a suggestion from the audience, and then this is the first part. And then we go on to this part. We take some of the ideas that come out of the first part and build it in this way. And then we do a musical section where we take those ideas and we make up songs about it. And then we come back around full circle to the first ideas we came up with and touch on those again and wrap up those stories. So it's improvised, but with a structure.
Structured improvise, right.
Yes. So she started that study, and she also started doing a little bit of stand-up. I think my husband and I went to her very first stand-up.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. If only we had cell phones back then. What?
I know. She would probably say she would be glad that there were no recording devices that were on mm-hmm. hand at that time. Because stand-up, a whole nother new thing that she had never done before. She was already a writer.
Right.
But there's a huge difference between writing that you expect someone to read, which she can do, as we know from her book, Bossy Pants.
Yeah. Nice plug.
Yes, nice book. And then another level of writing for playwriting, which is giving a different kind of information in a different way, but not the complete story.
Right.
As you would in, fiction or nonfiction writing. And then stand-up, then, is, again, extrapolated to another degree. It's writing in a sort of structure that's meant to be said, but how much information do you give to the audience to get it? How much do they have to fill in from their own experience? So I think wisely she went on to follow improvisation and creating scene writing from that, which is more of what Second City does, is they improv and then write down a scene.
Why Chicago? Why do you think Chicago is the home for improvisational theater?
That's a good question.
That's two good questions in a row, I've given you.
Gosh, Sean. You know, Chicago's a big city. It has a lot. It's a great place to live. I get the sense when we moved to Chicago, there was a lot of new play formation. There were a ton of small companies that seemed more concerned with creating interesting work rather than the big profession. You know, it was like more of a regional theater kind of environment, where the concern was having a nice life and living well, probably having to have another job to help support yourself, but being able to do creative work. So maybe it was the place that those of us who, you know, weren't dying to necessarily be on Broadway or
in Hollywood.
Yeah, Hollywood.
And that's the thing, you know, those New York and LA, those are industry towns. I mean, yes. LA especially is an industry town. It's run by Hollywood. New York, obviously, there's a lot of other things going on, but that's where professional theater is. That's where Broadway is. That's where scale and spectacle are. Chicago, I wonder, simply because it's in the Midwest. And, you know, the goals are, I don't know, modest. What was, when you and Brian moved to Chicago, what brought you there?
Well, we had many friends who had moved there, and we had just heard about the plethora of small theater groups. And I think neither one of us was really excited about the struggle that comes along with living in New York City.
Yeah.
We visited so many friends who, you know, you live on the maybe seventh floor walk up,
right?
You share an apartment with five other people, and the bathtub's in the kitchen.
And that didn't sound glamorous to you.
No, not too glamorous. Not saying it was, you know, easy living in Chicago and working other jobs, but I think it was a good bit easier than moving to New York.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of New York actors live in New York but get cast in regional theaters around the country. You know, theaters will come and audition, and you're out perhaps on the road for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you come back and you've had to sublet your apartment, and it just seemed to us it would be great to live somewhere and work in the same place.
Yeah. So how long were you in Chicago?
We were there for 4 years. And during that time, we got to see Tina start out with her beginning teams at Improv Olympic. Amy Poehler and her team at Improv Olympic, and got to watch their work and have fun. And I took classes there as well and had fun.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Nice.
It was great. It was a lot of fun. I loved it, but it didn't set me on fire like it did for Tina.
Right.
And I think she searched and found her thing, and then went on to work at Second City, and that's when she got the call to come and try and be a writer for SNL.
Saturday Night Live. So where were you in life when you started seeing Tina every Saturday night hosting Weekend Update?
Gosh, I think we had moved to Denver. My husband got a job in Denver working for MCI. Do you remember MCI?
Yeah, they were their telecom?
Yes,
yeah.
He had gotten a temp job in Chicago with MCI. And second day there, I think, they said, we need somebody who's kind of good on their feet to do this training session. Anybody want to do it? Nobody wanted to do it. And Brian said, sure, I'll do it. I talking. I do that well.
Right.
So from then on, he just went into organizational development and facilitation and training, all things that were skills that he brought from his theater training and morphed into a career in human resources.
So. Well, that's actually, dovetails nicely, which was kind of the theme of the show, which is how to take, in this case, theater techniques and apply them to everyday life. I mean, you talked about students who aren't drama students who come in and take your, what you call it, was it introduction to theater?
Intro to theater, but now it's actually going to change next semester to how theater works.
Okay.
Which I like even better.
Yeah. And you're coming in and using improv techniques to help business students. Your husband has a theater background, and he was using that in business. So now you've been here in Charlottesville for 7 years. Mm-hmm. You're a lecturer at UVA Drama. Brian works at UVA, but I know he continues to work in the theater. He's directing. Mm-hmm. He's acting. If people or theater goers here in town will have seen you or Brian on stage. Have you done any shows together since you've been here?
We have not together since we've been back here.
Well, that sounds like that needs to happen.
But, you know, Sean, partially that's because our roles as parents.
Parents, well, exactly. You're still,
we've got two daughters.
Two daughters, right.
Both in high school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, keeping up with their schedules and our schedules and being not willing to abandon them every night so we can be in rehearsal.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're not going to be with us much longer. We want to maximize that time.
Well, your oldest is just being accepted into colleges now,
yes,
right?
We're waiting on some final acceptance, hopefully acceptance. And so she'll be graduating at the end of this year, so we'll be down to one kid.
How about that?
Amazing.
My oldest is graduating from high school this year, but they're all still at home. So they look at their parents' lives, and they see how you've kept art and theater in your life and managed to sort of weave it in and out of your careers. Do you have a sense that they're interested in the same path?
I'm not sure. Both really like doing theater.
Mm-hmm.
I can definitely see my older daughter continuing in. Certainly, she's already talked about trying to go to a school where she can audition for shows and take classes in theater. I don't think it will be her main thing, but what I love about both of them is they've found their niche in the art world in some way.
Yeah.
My older daughter has a beautiful voice and is a singer and has done lots of musical theater and sings with the Virginia Consort.
Nice.
And really likes that, so that's really her thing. And my younger daughter plays the piano and the flute and the guitar, and it seems to be adding a new instrument daily, and is very much into music. And so I can see her continuing on that path. And at the same time, you know, they're both are great students and both good writers. And so I think that they have really taken from us, find things that you enjoy and make it a part of your life. And that doesn't mean you have to be mutually exclusive about anything, and how fun it is to be involved in the arts in any manner.
Perfect. That is a perfect summation of what I wanted to talk about in the show today. Thank you very much for coming in. And by the way, you too have a lovely singing voice.
Oh, thank you.
One of my favorite moments when we were doing our town together was when you would come out and sing. You stood like 3 feet in front of me and sing a song every night, and it just kind of set the mood for that whole third act.
Very kind of you.
This is Sean McCord. This is the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, the special Christmas week edition, pre-recorded. So happy holidays. Happy holidays to my guest. And I hope that all our listeners, when this is broadcast, had a fine Christmas and are enjoying this weekend. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call airs at 11 a.m. on WPVC 94.7. Oh my gosh, Katie, I just got through the whole hour and I just realized that was the first time that I mentioned the station name and the call letters. So I better do it again. This is WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville on 94.7 FM. This has been Sean McCord subbing in for Rick Moore. We hope you enjoyed the show and we hope that all of you out there listening have found ways to integrate your own arts and your own interests into your very full lives. Happy New Year, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.